welcome to With All Due Respect, where we discuss the big topics with respect and a bit of grace as well. I'm Michael Jensen and she's...
Well, we'll give it a go. I'm Megan Powell Dutoit.
Now, in this episode, we're going to need our grace. Australia is gearing up to reach its 80% 16-plus vaccination rate sometime within the next few weeks, probably 90% not far after that, with some states way ahead of others. The news has been dominated by both federal and state plans for what reopening will look like with COVID present in Australia. Within that, Christians have had particular concerns. What will be the rules around face-to-face church gatherings, and how should we as Christians respond to the risk and freedoms of opening? We have asked an epidemiologist, Professor Greg Fox, on to, with all due respect, to answer questions from a public health perspective. And then Megan and I will talk about the theologically informed response, or at least attempt one, that might come from churches. We finish then with a novel which explores what one church did during a plague, Year of Wonders by Geraldine Brooks.
Be our guest, opening up the conversation to others. Professor Greg Fox is a respiratory physician and epidemiologist. He is Research Academic Director, Internationalisation, for the Sydney University Faculty of Medicine and Health. He's also a research leader at the Wilcock Institute of Medical Research and a National Health and Medical Research Council Career Development Fellow. Well, welcome to With All Due Respect, Professor Fox. We're really glad to have you on to talk to us about the situation of opening up with the Delta variant of COVID in the community. How has Delta, in your mind, changed the situation we're dealing with?
So I think that the Delta variant is a very different virus to the one that we experienced last year in Sydney. The main difference is that it's much more infectious. So instead of one person with Delta, with the virus affecting maybe 2 to 3 people, the Delta variant can spread maybe up to 6 or even 9 times from a single person. So that means that you don't need to have that many people in the community with the Delta variant for there to be widespread transmission. And so that means as well that when we have implemented our public health measures, they haven't been as effective because there's a greater chance that the virus will break through some of those measures that we've been relying upon in 2020.
So we're getting the roadmap in various states to opening up. What are your concerns about these, about what's going to happen when we open up our community once more?
So I think our government leaders are increasingly recognising, based on the experience overseas, that with the Delta variant, it's probably not going to be sufficient just to get to a certain level of vaccination and then sort of switch off all the public health measures and then we go back to normal. I think the experience in countries such as Israel, the United Kingdom, and even parts of the United States where they've had very high vaccination rates is that that despite vaccination, that it's still likely that there'll be an increase in case numbers once we relax some of those restrictions. And so I think wisely, there is a fair degree of caution in much of the public health community in Australia to take an incremental approach rather than to sort of open the floodgates, so to speak. And I know from some of the Northern Hemisphere countries that opened up very rapidly over the Northern Hemisphere summer, they then have had to reintroduce restrictions again, such as mask wearing and some of the social restrictions, because perhaps things were opened up too quickly. So I think in Australia, what we will be looking at is the experience of New South Wales and seeing how in the early weeks after we start to relax our restrictions, after we reach the 80% target, how that goes in terms of cases. And the second thing to say is that we've been really fixated on the number of daily cases in Australia. I know that you know, in New South Wales, we've had the Gladys hour at 11 o'clock every morning, and we've been avidly looking at the numbers. I think we're going to need to sort of shift our thinking a little bit beyond the number of cases to look at the downstream effects in terms of hospitalizations and deaths, because once we do open up, there'll be a lot more transmission amongst younger people and also people who've already been vaccinated. And both of those groups have a much lower chance of having to go to hospital with COVID. So I think we'll need to have a more nuanced understanding of what those daily numbers mean.
What kind of, so talking about those numbers, cases and deaths, and the load on the hospital system, what do you think it will look like, or is it too hard to tell at this point in time?
Look, I think in all cases, it's good to plan for the worst and hope for the best. Mm-hmm. And I think at the moment, both in New South Wales and Victoria, in the later part of September, the health system is holding, and some of the worst situations that we'd feared have not occurred. Mm. And so I think that that we need to have obviously a cautious approach, and also to ensure that we have reserve within the health system, so that if the numbers do go up, that we're ready to deal with them. And you know, the last 18 months really has given the health systems time to prepare in things such as the availability of equipment, the availability of staff, and plans to put in place if the numbers do go up. So the question that you're asking really is what is likely to happen? I think we're likely to see an increase in case numbers, and the real question will be, does that then translate to hospital admissions? And I think if we start to see a lot of pressure on the health system, there'll be in turn the need to sort of maybe reintroduce further measures. So I think there'll be a little bit of cat and mouse going on of just looking at the effect, and then if necessary winding back some of those freedoms until the health system can cope.
Now, there's been a lot of anxiety and discussion about the relation of the vaccinated to the unvaccinated, some people saying, look, actually, you're more at risk from the vaccinated than you are from the unvaccinated. Actually, once we get to high proportions of the vaccinated can still transmit the disease and all that sort of thing. To what extent does the vaccination protect both the person and the community? And to what degree are the unvaccinated a danger?
Look, I think this is an important question. And obviously, both vaccinated and unvaccinated people are concerned to make sure that they're not at a high risk in the situation that there is a lot of community transmission. We do know from some very good data that the risk of symptomatic COVID-19 is reduced by 88% for the Delta variant after two doses, and 67% for the AstraZeneca vaccine after two doses. So that's very, you know, substantial reduction. However, some community studies in the UK show that in addition to the people who are protected against getting symptomatic disease, some people will get asymptomatic disease. And so the effectiveness in preventing any infection is probably not quite as good as the numbers that I just gave you. So one study in the New England Journal of Medicine found that there's about a 54% reduction in any form of COVID-19 with vaccination. So That indicates that even if you have been vaccinated, if there's a lot of transmission going on, that it's possible to get infected. But the consequences for those people who do get infected are much less. And so there's a much, much lower risk of having to be hospitalized, and a much lower risk of having to seek intensive care support. Having said all of that, obviously a person who has been vaccinated and is infected could potentially be infectious as well. And so we need to be still protecting our vulnerable populations who haven't yet been vaccinated until the time that we can get vaccines out there.
Does that, what would you think would be the good vaccination level for a COVID normal society? So one where we're reasonably open up, what do we need to get to?
So I think, as with many of these discussions, it's probably a continuum. So in fact, the 80% threshold for adults, probably translates to something like 65% or so of all people in the population, because that number, of course, doesn't include young kids. Mm. And so I think the higher the vaccination rate in people who may get really severe disease, the better. And I know in New South Wales, for example, there's a goal to aim for 90% or the chief health officer thinks even above. And I think that that's the sort of level that we really need to be looking at. You've seen in say, for example, the US, where there's been very patchy vaccination in some populations, that they've been the populations that have been predominantly affected as the Delta wave has spread through the country. And so really it's incumbent upon us to try and vaccinate any vulnerable populations. One of the questions is going to be those younger kids and what is the importance of vaccinating them. And certainly there are studies underway, and I think, you know, later in the year we'll probably have clearer evidence about the benefits of vaccination for that young group. But certainly when we have people who are younger who are transmitters, they can still infect people who are older and who are vulnerable.
So we're going to be seeing masks worn in the community for the foreseeable future, and windows open in buildings, and reduced numbers in venues?
Look, I think so. Each state is going to make its own decisions, but I note that even in New South Wales after the start of December, that face mask wearing on public transport will still be a part of their response. And I think that, you know, it is sensible to implement something which is very easy to do and is very effective in places where there are people close together indoors. I think the story outdoors is different because it's much less likely to transmit outdoors, and so it's appropriate that those restrictions be lifted. But I think we will be seeing mask use until we can be confident that the number of people in the community with COVID is low.
Actually, I just want to come back to what you said about children. I know that they're not as likely to to die or get that kind of serious disease, but there has been some question over long COVID. Do we know much about how it might affect children in the long? I mean, obviously, we haven't had a longer term. What is the current thinking around that?
Yeah, so long COVID is a condition where people have ongoing symptoms after they recover from the acute illness. And that's certainly been seen in a small proportion of younger children, but the risk is much less than for older adults. Mm-hmm. And so one of the arguments for vaccinating young kids and protecting young kids is to try and avoid that small risk that there might be some ongoing symptoms. And so, you know, when you have a situation like in the UK where there's very large numbers of kids being infected, then you're going to see more of that. But I think reassuringly, there are some data from the UK which showed very, very good survival rates. So in a study from pre-Delta from the start of 2021, end of 2020, showed 99.995% of kids with COVID-19 survived. So, you know, that's a pretty pretty good outcome, I think, for young kids. So I think the parents can be reassured about this low risk. But, of course, you know, we all want to do everything we can to protect kids against any long-term effects.
Yeah.
So what about global access to the vaccine? I mean, at one level, we've been focused on our local community, particularly New South Wales, not just even Australia, but there's a problem with inequity over the distribution of the vaccine. What are we going to see and what can we do?
The access to COVID vaccines around the world is a critical priority, and in fact, both for countries which have got limited resources and also for higher income countries, because of course, if there is rampant transmission of the virus in many parts of the world, then that increases the chance that there are going to be new strains that emerge and potentially could even challenge the vaccines or the other methods of control that we have. So I think there's a global interest, as well, of course, as a really important moral responsibility that we have for poorer countries, in particular in our region. The global community has recognised this as a priority, and a number of governments are putting substantial resources into supplying vaccines. But in much of Africa, for example, the vaccine uptake rate, you know, is paltry, just, you know, in the sort of 1-3% range.
Wow.
And that really, you know, has potentially, you know, severe effects for their populations, particularly for the older members of their communities. And so I think as wealthy countries where we have an abundant supply of very effective vaccines, that we do have a responsibility to reach out there and support other countries. Personally, I've been involved in some work on COVID in Vietnam, where the government has really been doing its best to scale up the vaccines to the large urban areas, but the access to vaccines in many of the poorer and more remote communities has been limited, and really it's a lack of supply that's the problem. And so in many countries in our region, really we need to be doing as much as we can to get those vaccine supplies out there.
And what are the implications for us with that global access? Does it affect, for instance, new variants arising if there's not adequate vaccination overall? Or
so I think the best protection against new variants is widespread vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important to look at countries where they have very low rates of vaccination and try and support them as much as possible. And we're in a really challenging period where there is still a need to vaccinate a large number of people, and the supply still isn't there yet. And so I think in the meantime, we're going to need to try as a global community to prioritise vaccination for people who benefit most. And so hence there's a legitimate discussion around whether having booster vaccines for populations that may be pretty low-risk populations in Western countries should be considered, while we still have many people who are very vulnerable in our region who still haven't received the vaccine.
Now, I'm a pastor of a church, and I've got to manage getting back to some kind of normality to meeting together. Help me here. What should I do? Because the government, in one sense, is saying, particularly after December, it's not going to regulate a lot of things. So what would you recommend churches do, and particularly around the idea of the controversial idea of vaccine passports?
So I think in Australia, we are really blessed to have a range of different ways that we can protect members of our church community against COVID-19. I think vaccines are clearly the most effective single intervention that we could offer. And so I think as members of the church community, we can be encouraging people to consider vaccines, and if they have concerns, to take those up with their general practitioner or other people who can really talk through them with them in detail. But in addition to that, I think as churches, we can be looking at ways that we can protect people who may not be vaccinated by some other public health measures that we have available. One of the important ones is ventilation, so making sure that our church buildings are well ventilated to minimise the risk of transmission, making sure that we keep a track of people who come to church so that if there is a case, that people can be informed and isolated if appropriate, and then using masks and trying to reduce transmission through appropriate distancing within the church buildings and following the public health advice about those things. So I think with that suite of approaches that we can protect people who are not vaccinated, and also we can try and minimise the risk that there'll be transmission of COVID-19.
Would you say the claim is made that vaccinated people demanding that unvaccinated people be excluded is mathematically unjustified, quite apart from the theological issues? Is that accurate?
It depends a lot on the risk that there is COVID-19 in the community and the number of people who are unvaccinated. Obviously, the smaller proportion of people who are unvaccinated and the less transmission that there is in the community, the less of a problem that's going to be for transmission in church. And so I think it will be an advantage to churches to try and minimise the number of people who could potentially be infected, and that means to try and make sure that everybody's protecting themselves when they're not at church. So when they come to church, when they're meeting together, that there's a minimal risk. And the risk of transmission is obviously greatest in the period just before and around the time people start to get symptomatic. So people should be really conscious of their symptoms and getting tested if they do think that they could have COVID-19.
Well, thanks. Is there any? It's been very helpful, I think, for helping people to think this through. Are there any parting words you have for the Christian community in Australia?
So COVID-19 has had a major effect upon us all in a whole host of ways. And I think one of the really important ways is on the mental health of our communities. Mm. And as we meet back together again, I think, I'd encourage people to really look after one another and, be reaching out to try and reconnect people. I think COVID-19 has been highly stigmatized, and we're going to have to come now, I think, to the acceptance that it's going to be in the community and widespread. And so when people are affected, to make sure that we are embracing them and loving them and not stigmatizing them and not blaming them for their disease.
So thank you so much, Professor Greg Fox, for joining us today and giving us these insights and helping us through. And we do, of course, rely on the power of prayer in this as well. But thank you so much for your expertise.
You're welcome. Great to be with you.
Well, we've heard from a medical expert, but what do we as theologians and pastors think about how the church should respond to the current crisis? And after that, we discuss a novel of how the church responded way back in the plague of 1666. Now, we really wanted to tell you about the project that our partners at Anglican Aid are supporting. It's a project called Heading North, and it's about helping people in Ethiopia in a really incredible and holistic way. What's been going on there, Megan?
Well, of course, COVID is happening in Ethiopia, and we know some of the problems with that. But, of course, in somewhere which already has a lot of issues they're dealing with, it's been the effect has been immense. So they've had added conflict. They haven't been able to bring the harvest in. A lot of women in particular have been in very dire need without anything to eat. So Anglican Aid have found themselves having to find what the problems are and respond really quickly. So at the moment, your money is helping with very significant issues that are just arising out of nowhere that they're having to deal with in an urgent fashion.
As always with these things, a little bit of Western money goes an awful long way. So go over to anglicanaid.org.au and support them. Give them a hand as they help people in dire need in Ethiopia. For argument's sake, when we take a debate, cut out the party politics and try to talk it out. Now, the state plans around reopening when we reach vaccination milestones have created particular dilemmas for the church. That's different from state to state in Australia. As various freedoms have been discussed as applying to the vaccinated but not to the unvaccinated, at least for a time, the church has grappled with what it is to be the church in such a scenario. What does God require of us? What does it mean to welcome all? That seems fundamental to what the church is about. With the Ezekiel Declaration and the Moses Statement, some conservative Christians seem to be invoking the authority of Old Testament figures in favour of no restrictions, while many others, including some who would also identify as conservative, have argued against these statements, thinking of David Ould and Murray Campbell. While different places will have somewhat different laws to grapple with, we wanted to ask how Christians should be thinking this through theologically. What do you reckon, Megan?
I think this is quite a nuanced topic with quite a few different ways to think about it. And so I've been quite sort of startled at how black and white some of the conversation has been about this. I don't know about you.
Black and white. I mean, is it just because of the emotional tone and the anxiety? Do you think that people are kind of being more dogmatic? In what direction do you see that sort of black and whiteness?
Well, on one side, it's the extent of God requires us to meet together, when in fact they've been doing lockdown church for some time, or there is no excuse to ever exclude anyone, when in fact I think churches have excluded people in different ways, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for bad reasons. And then also on the other side, kind of the idea of we must protect the vulnerable without thinking about perhaps how it contributes to people's mental health and well-being in a more general sense. So I do think that there's a path here where we need to think theologically, we need to think through all the different ramifications for both the church but also for public health. And we need to be aware as well. One of the things that I've been thinking is quite odd in the conversation is how it gets talked about in sort of absolute terms, rather than understanding that what we're talking about often is temporary measures in the middle of a pandemic. They're not setting up the way that the church is expected to behave for all time.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reactions, I think, rightly to the Ezekiel Declaration was a kind of sense of mistrust of government, that here was the government illegitimately overstretching, whereas its mandate to interfere in religion. And while I would want to uphold the principle of the separation of church and state, I'm a massive advocate of that, of course. This is a crisis situation in which we understand the state, which may be clumsy, but I think there is a general good intention to protect the community. I don't think there's a particular persecution of churches going on any more than there's a particular persecution of football or whatever it might be. You know, there's just, we're a part of the community. We love gathering together. And so I think that the government is trying its best to navigate through that. So I don't think that argument is particularly legitimate. But what about the argument, because I think there's two important theological arguments. Mm. One is what imperative is there for us to meet together in person? What does that look like theologically? And then secondly, the issue of conscience and whether this is a case of meat offered to idols, as in 1 Corinthians 8-10 and in Romans. So what do you think about the meeting together imperative?
Well, it's interesting. There's a couple of things to tease out there. First, I don't think the Bible is written in a way to talk to an online world, right?
Turns out not.
No. So,
although Paul does talk about his letters as mediating his presence, interestingly.
And interestingly too, Paul is prevented in his case, say through prison, from being able to meet with him face to face, but he uses the letters. Now, it's a different prevention, but actually it's one where the state's involved and he himself doesn't have a lot of control of it, but he's not in that sense therefore in error. You know, he's not required to do anything he can to get out of that situation so he can meet face to face with people. It's understandable that things are going to happen in this world in which we will at times be prevented from meeting face to face, and there's the New Testament letters, or in our case, we have had other things like online. So I just think it's very odd to create a whole argument of it has to be physical, as if God is making a requirement of physical presence, rather than acknowledging that, of course, God made us embodied people. So meeting in an embodied way is preferable, but not always achievable.
Well, it's to be longed for. I mean, this is Paul longs to be reunited with the Philippians, for instance. It's, you know, with the affections of Christ, it's really palpable, his longing. And I got to say, I hope for godly Christians that's the case. I think it would be, I mean, would you agree that for Christians who could otherwise, for no other reason, they had nothing to prevent them to not meet together in person, that would be suboptimal? It would not really... It would be disobedient in a way.
Well, it depended how you're doing it. I think it's an ongoing thing. If you were deciding to do church just as a consuming a video on a screen and not actually meeting with people, well, when you've got other options, then that's not really being part of a community. And I think a lot of churches have been trying to find ways around that to produce community where it's not just being consumed on a screen. But of course, what is the whole church? I mean, we do have different size congregations. We don't have, a lot of churches don't have the whole church meeting at any one particular time. They meet at various different times. And, you know, two or three, like household themselves, have been sort of gatherings of the church. So obviously the being able to meet with more people who might be able to have input into your life is good. But let's not underplay the different ways that we are able to meet with God's people.
No, not at all. And which people have been doing. And I mean, we in normal times we would try and include those who are shut in by visits and by having communion and so on. By letters and contact and newsletters and all of the rest. And perhaps this period has actually helped us to do that much better since we've all been in the class of shut-ins.
Yeah.
I think physical presence is something that the Holy Spirit desires. It produces the desire for us in. And so I think Christians have got to want to be together, but I don't think it's kind of like this kind of massive it's not an imperative where there are other reasons. For other considerations like safety or ill health or whatever it might be.
And when you say want to be, I think that it is legitimate for people to make decisions or be afraid of meeting when there are risks. So it could be that some people are going to say, look, I'm not ready to come back now. I've got a child who's not vaccinated or someone that I spend a lot of time with who's immune compromised, and so I'm going to delay it. And I think there shouldn't be any sort of feeling of that person doesn't want to be in community. Well, that person probably does, but is also wanting to look after safety and has some concerns there.
Now, the second or the next issue is really the unity or the not turning anyone away principle, which is linked to the meat offered to idols conscience objection thing. So now I have some sympathy for this objection because I do think it is of the church's essence. You know, it's our essence that we are inclusive as possible. We don't discriminate. The gospel is for all, and so the church community is for all. And so I understand the desire not to do that. And I also, by the way, I see the heated rhetoric that is being unleashed against the unvaccinated, with whom I don't have a lot of sympathy at one level. But people have pointed out to me, and I've seen statistical evidence from the United States, that those who are not vaccinated tend to be amongst the more excluded social classes in general. So we all know the sort of middle class unvaccinated person.
Yeah, although I have been looking at the in New South Wales, since we've had a greater push towards equity of access and reaching out to communities which may not have been adequately reached out before. And now I think you're actually seeing that when people have equitability of access, when they've been approached through community specific ways, that they're taking up the vaccine just as much. So in fact, some of the in Sydney, some of the LGAs with really good vaccine take up at the moment in the 90s of the first dose are some of the poorer LGAs.
Yes, although these are in the States, these are people who are adamant that they won't get it. So these are people who are actually
anti. I'm not sure we're getting that in Australia as much as what I'm saying when we look at the figures.
No, well, I think that'll be true just because of our social conditions. But what I'm wary of is that actually those who are unvaccinated, who are opposed to and determined to be, will be already part of excluded social groups, and that the opprobrium with which they're being treated leads to further division and exclusion. Whereas now that doesn't mean we should just not keep safe, but I think it's really important for church communities to operate in a way that unites, that takes into account those people in and will actually perhaps through that help them to change their minds.
I think that we need to be careful on how we're talking about this, because some of the conversation I've heard uses examples in the Bible which are about difficult to change or inherent qualities. So when you look at the Bible, it talks about the unity now present, male, female, slave, free, Jew, Gentile. They're all difficult to change things, right, about a person.
Well, not these days, apparently. But anyway, go on.
Right. Well, that's the that was a red herring, Michael.
Yeah, it was.
this is a behaviour, so it's somewhat different. And I think this becomes more of a, rather than looking at it as a people are being excluded because they're in a particular group, because I don't think it's that clear. I think it's people who are making decisions based on information they've got or pressures upon them, which may not be very helpful information. Rather, we need to look at this as a discipleship thing, I think. And what the church is about being welcoming and inclusive to all people because there's grace, but also then being transformative place. It's not somewhere where you welcome people and don't ask them to develop their understanding or to develop who they are or to be thinking of what the basis of their behaviour should be. And so I would hope that there would be both that urge to come alongside people, but then also to not leave them there as if it's a static grouping, as if the unvaccinated is some kind of forever after grouping, but rather to sort of say what I think, so therefore Christian leaders promoting vaccination, particularly of what we've been hearing about, we really need to get into the 90s in the percentages to actually have a society which can live with COVID, that we should be having a community-minded attitude here. Because I think there's something wrong in my mind about having a church being somewhere, on the other hand, where it feels like one of the unsafest places in the community.
Yes, I mean, I still want to see the statistic, the kind of actual facts about that. Is there a point at which, you know, given the numbers, you are actually okay, you're as safe as you can be? So I do want to, as a minister, I really have to kind of manage that, particularly after December the 1st. So that's the challenge we have before us.
Yeah, and I think the thing to be going on with is to be looking at not what my rights are, but how do I most love all the different groups that could be considered here in a way that promotes the gospel in every way in our community. Still to come, back in 2001, acclaimed author Geraldine Brooks wrote a fictionalised account of an interesting historical event, a village that quarantined itself to avoid spreading the Black Death. We take a look at this now highly relevant novel next.
We want to tell you about another podcast, and this is a podcast with a particular twist to it. It's a difficult time to be dating. I mean, I haven't dated since the 1980s myself, but if I were dating, then this particular podcast called Love Online would be where I'd go to find out more about how to do the online thing, especially as a Christian.
Oh, I mean, I've been thinking about it, thinking it must be so difficult this time where we're all thinking, how do we develop relationships? Well, how do you develop a dating relationship during COVID? So that's one of the things they're teasing out here. How do you try and make those connections, develop sensibly, but also really getting to know each other in an online environment, particularly when you might be in different countries? So if you want to hear more about that, go to eternitypodcast.com. Marg and Dave, two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. Well, the story this time is Year of Wonders, a novel of the plague. It's a 2001 best-selling novel by Australian-American Pulitzer winner Geraldine Brooks. It's based on the Derbyshire village of Eam, that in 1666, during a Black Death outbreak, the ministers, the Anglican minister and the nonconformist pastor, joined forces to persuade the village to various public health measures, including relocating church services to outside and quarantining the entire village to protect those of outside of the village. So that's all historical as well. That's not even fictionalised from her. That is what happened at that time. Let's have a listen to Geraldine Brooks herself reading the opening.
Leaf Fall, 1666. Apple picking time. I used to love this season. The wood stacked by the door, the tang of its sap still speaking of forest. The hay made, all golden in the low afternoon light. The rumble of the apples tumbling into the cellar bins. Smells and sights and sounds that said this year it would be all right. There'd be food and warmth for the babies by the time the snows came. I used to love to walk in the apple orchard at this time of year, to feel the soft give underfoot when I trod on a fallen fruit. Thick, sweet scents of rotting apple and wet wood. This year, the haystooks are few and the woodpile scant, and neither matters much to me. They brought the apples yesterday, a cartload for the rectory cellar. They were late picking, of course. I saw brown spots on more than a few. I had words with the carter over it, but he told me we were lucky to get as good as we got, and I suppose it's true enough. There are so few people to do the picking, so few people to do anything, and those of us who are left walk around as if we're half asleep. We are all so tired.
Well, Michael, I read this back in, say, early 2000s, when pandemics seemed like just historical events to me. I reread it again during a pandemic, and I have to say it was it really resonated with me, a lot of this, reading it during a pandemic. What was, you hadn't read it before, so what was your experience?
Well, I started off really liking it. I've got to say, when you have the Anglican minister and the nonconformist pastor getting together, I thought they might do a podcast, but no, they joined forces to persuade the village to. And I liked that because at first the Puritans were seen in the historical cliche as a sort of funless lot, and that's very stock, and then. But she redeemed the Puritan, Mr. Stanley, who became good in the end. And I love the depiction. This is one of the better depictions of an Anglican minister in fiction. So I kind of liked that a lot. I think she's a terrific writer, and I've loved Geraldine Brooks's work in other settings. And she often uses religion or Christian themes, though she's not herself. She calls herself a secular person. But the more I read, the less I was convinced that Anna, the heroine, wasn't actually a middle-class 21st century woman and an example of a secular, you know, sort of a liberal democratic person, a humanist. The theological discussions were shallow and predictable, and I think they were done better in The Plague by Camus, where there's a priest figure who kind of goes through all of this stuff, and then there's a humanist doctor, similar kind of setup. So I don't think she really inhabits the life of faith from the inside with any conviction. And so then the minister kind of drops it. And it starts out, this is not a spoiler, it starts out with him sort of losing his faith, or sort of in the crisis of doubt. And that's a very predictable humanist outcome. Of course, if you go through suffering like this, you must doubt God and therefore lose your faith. I mean, who wouldn't? And so everybody becomes a practical humanist herbalist in the end.
Well, kind of. Although there is sort of a measure in the end of there's a different type of faith, a more questioning one, I think. But I think what was interesting for me was, and perhaps I look at it, had different expectations, but the way that it sort of showed faith, Christian faith, and also kind of an unthinking belief, particularly in things like witches and so on, as not being the same thing. And I thought that was quite helpful, that actually it's an informed faith, a reasonable faith, one that is interacting with the world as it is, that saves the day, if you like, in Eam, while it's the almost the conspiracy theory people, or the people who see witches and demons and that kind of faith, that becomes problematic for the people in Eam.
Yeah, I love that. I love that point. You know, that was really good, because I felt like the faith inspired the minister, and Anna was certainly, you know, was devout in her way, and the minister's wife, who's really, you know, really strong character. By the end of it, that had kind of become an emaciated faith, and so I was a bit disappointed. That didn't seem to me historically real, necessarily the outcome.
I found the ending a little bit disappointing in that way, and then I found it probably would have happened. And the rest of the book, I think, was just so careful with how trying to be reasonably historically connected. And really, I felt maybe the faith was a bit shallow in how it was discussed, but I felt it really inhabited what it was like to be in a pandemic really well. So I actually think it's a good read at the moment, and interesting to think through that idea of how can you have an informed faith versus an uninformed and fearful faith. That, for me, was the takeaway.
Well, thanks for being part of With All Due Respect. Coming up next episode, we move from The Plague to poetry. We thought maybe poetry has something powerful to say in this contemporary time.
So we're going to interview poet and academic Lachlan Brown. We're going to talk about faithful poetry and the persuasive power of the poet.
So see you then.
Talk to you then.
With All Due Respect is hosted by Megan Powell Dutoit and Michael Jensen. That's me. Produced by Mark Hadley. Editing by Nicholas Van Soest. With All Due Respect is part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Head to eternitypodcasts.com, where you'll find show notes and other stuff related to our episodes, and click onto our Facebook page to join in the debates. With All Due Respect.
Brought to you by the Eternity Podcast Network.